during the presentation. I do this on my own without my guide dog, because I like to have my hands free to feel around me. I've been on thousands of stages in my life, but one day I was on a stage that was built unlike any other I'd ever been on. Most have a set of stairs on the side that lead up to the stage. But on this one, there was a small landing right before you got to the top. And then you had to turn left and take one more step up to get onto the stage. My assistant at the time, Hope, had described how the stage was built, but I was kind of distracted. I had to give two speeches that day, and I was still getting into the zone. Even though Hope had warned me, I didn't realize that the stairs turned. So when I got to the landing, I just kept going and walked straight off, falling 5 feet to the concrete floor below. I landed on my right hip and instinctively wrenched my neck to the left to stop myself from smashing my head open. Later, I would learn that turning my head like that had torn all the small tissues and ligaments on the left side of my neck. Stunned, at the time, I just iced my hip and didn't even really think about my neck, because I was in shock and didn't really comprehend what had happened. Now I know that with muscular damage, you don't really feel the full effects of the pain until up to 48 hours later. I just knew that I needed to give one speech and then another, so that's what I did. The show must go on. After I got home, I called my boyfriend and my parents and told them all what had happened. Oh my God, haha, I walked off the stage. I thought it was just a funny blind girl moment and didn't really take it seriously. That night, my dad came over to walk Gypsy and check up on me. And then I took a sleeping pill so I could get a good night's sleep and wake up feeling fresh. Every time I tossed or turned that night, I felt a sharp pain in my neck. But I was in such a deep sleep that it didn't really register. In my medicated haze, it just felt like I had a crick in my neck from sleeping funny. When I woke up in the morning, my mom had already let herself into my apartment with her set of keys, and the pain was now radiating all down the base of my skull through my shoulder. Sometimes it's just nice to have your mom, you know? She drove me to the hospital where they told me the extent of the muscular damage I had done, and that I had gotten severe whiplash when I jerked my head to the left during the fall. They put me in one of those very trendy foam neck braces and sent me home. And even just being in the car was so painful. Every little bump would send pain shooting down my neck. I took a couple days off work and went to my osteopath to start my physical recovery. But I ended up going back to work just a few days later with my trendy neck brace still on. I've never been somebody who gets nervous before I speak. If anything, I feel the most alive on stage. But all of a sudden, I started getting stomach pains and nervous diarrhea before I would go up. Hey, I'm an honest queen. It happens to the best of us. I would get nauseated, my heart would start racing. And worst of all, when I would finally get up there, I felt like I was physically falling through a hole. I'd learned the layout of the stage beforehand, but I would still freeze up and get this panicked feeling that I was going to fall off. Up until then, I'd been living the dream, traveling the world with celebrities, but now I felt like I could barely function. I became anxious that I'd never be able to speak again and I would have to give up my dream job. I had a speech coming up at Wembley Arena in London that I was really excited about. Richard Branson, Ellie Goulding, Prince Harry, Luna Lovegood, aka actress Ivana Lynch. All of these amazing people, and we would be speaking to an audience of 20,000. But I was still having all of these weird physical symptoms, and I kept consulting my doctor and my nutritionist to figure out what was wrong. The night before I left for England, I was really excited, because Matt was going to be coming to London to be a part of the event with me. We had been apart while he was studying abroad in Wales for 6 months, and I missed him. After London, we planned a 2-week trip through Europe together, including a stop in Ireland where he would meet my extended family. But it was hard to keep my spirits up because I was feeling so awful. The only things I could really get down were those little baby arrowroot cookies and some fruit snacks, which my mom and I were stuffing into my carry-on to make sure I'd be able to get through this. She even made Matt promise to buy a hand blender so he could blend me smoothies, because that was one of the few foods I could get down. I had already lost so much weight. During a break in packing, my mom and I were researching my symptoms. And that's when she stumbled across this list and started reading it out to me. Reliving traumatic events. Feeling nervous or tense. Changes in sleeping patterns. Anxiety, panic attacks. IBS, restlessness. Racing thoughts, obsessive thoughts. Irritability, nausea, feeling impending doom. And boom, I was like, that's me, that's me. What is it, Mom? She looked at me and said, that's PTSD. Immediately, I felt this wave of relief wash over me. It was so freeing to know what was going on and that it was treatable. At the time, canceling the London trip seemed like it was out of the question. My flight was the next morning. I had a speech to give. And I was going to get to see my boyfriend. So I went, and it was a really difficult trip. I wasn't myself at all. When I got back, I went to my doctor. He told me he wanted me to take a 6-week medical leave. Once again, I was stunned. I couldn't take a 6-week leave. I was supposed to be in San Francisco in 2 days to do an event with Selena Gomez. How could I take a break from my dream job? But my doctor said, here are your options. You take a 6-week medical leave and heal your brain, or you push through and damage your brain for years to come. Ouch. So I took my medical leave. During my leave, I started to heal from my injury and did some thinking. I knew I had to find a way to pursue my dream, but in a different way. After a long, hard look at the situation, I decided to leave the job I had been at for 2 years and start my own business. And just as all of this was happening, my sweet gypsy got sick and passed away. I couldn't eat, I was barely functioning, and I worried that I would never reach that level of success again. I was terrified. When I talked about what was going on with my psychologist and my cognitive behavior therapist, we all decided that I needed medication. After all that had happened, my brain chemistry was too far gone to get back to a healthy place without it. A common analogy to address the stigma around psychiatric medication is that if you had a broken wrist, you'd put a cast on it without question. If you had diabetes, you would take your insulin because it saves your life. So why wouldn't you take medication for a mental illness? Still, I had always been so proud of myself for getting through my earlier depression with just a natural lifestyle, seeing a psychologist, and taking time for myself. This time, though, I quickly realized that if I didn't take medication, it would probably kill me. Not because I would have consciously made that choice, but because I wasn't taking care of myself and I was in such an unhealthy downward spiral. This seems like a good place to mention that people with physical disabilities are at more risk for mental illness like depression and anxiety. Stigma and ableism can make it much harder to find a job, and they can also cause social isolation and loss of independence. Together, all of these things can lead to overwhelming feelings of helplessness. It's a recipe for depression and anxiety, and I've had a taste of that. I consider myself very lucky that I've always had a great team of supporters around me, and that I've learned to ask for help when I really need it. Gallup also came into my life at this time, which was a huge step in my recovery. Things were tough, but they were going to be okay. When I first quit my job, I felt like a failure who was giving up on my dream. I would spend days at a time watching nothing but YouTube in my bed. But then I started watching Dragon's Den and Shark Tank, and I was hooked. Not just on the shows, but on the idea of starting a business. I binged as many episodes as humanly possible, learning all about what it's like to be an entrepreneur, hearing inspiring success stories, and researching the ins and outs of starting a business. They really fueled and inspired me to dream big. And I began plotting my next move. I was going to start my own speaking business. Chapter 8. There's always a light. You just have to turn it on. One perk of starting my own business is that I had a little bit of extra free time on my hands. I wasn't about to just sit around doing nothing. So I decided to find another creative outlet to share my story. I wanted to find a place to talk about all the things nobody would ever book me to talk about. like my love of tea, makeup, nutrition, and glitter. Everyone always wants to hear me speak about bullying, mental illness, disabilities. And those are all a part of my story, but there's so much more to me than that too. I started blogging once a week and decided to do something else I had been wanting to try for a long time. I was going to start my own YouTube channel. YouTube's beauty and lifestyle community had been a huge part of my life when I was feeling so alone and isolated. Even then, I had talked about starting my own channel one day. Now I was finally ready to do it. I never expected it to become what it is today. To me, it was just a fun hobby that doubled as free marketing for my speaking business. It was also a way to stay connected to my audience after speaking events. And maybe I would even be able to build my own little community on the internet of people who needed to hear my message but wouldn't have the opportunity to see me live. I had a lot of false starts before I finally uploaded my first video. Usernames were all the rage when I was 16. And I decided that my username would be BlindBeauty101. I know, super cringe. Thank God I held off. I was already dealing with so much bullying that I decided not to open myself up to another opportunity for ridicule. Silver lining, people. Later, when I was at my full-time public speaking job, I approached our social media team about making YouTube videos for our company. I even filmed a Q&A at our in-house studio using questions people had sent into my Facebook page. But the footage never got edited or posted. It just wasn't my time yet. The summer I started my own business was also the same summer that the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge was trending. For those of you who were under a rock that summer, over 17 million people filmed themselves dumping buckets of ice water over their heads to raise awareness for the disease ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Matt's roommate posted a video of him doing it and challenged me to do it next. I'm a complete baby about cold water, or anything cold, to be honest. But I had to do it because it was for such a good cause. So Matt set up the camera and then he dumped the water on my head. Most people were putting their ice bucket challenges on Facebook, but I decided to upload mine to YouTube and that would be my first video. I don't know when I would have uploaded my first video if I hadn't been tagged in the challenge. But once I had one video up, I thought, well, I guess I'll just keep going. My second video was a Q&A about my new guide dog, and the rest is history. Being blind, I wasn't really able to create videos by myself, and I'm thankful that my mom and Matt were there to help me. I had saved up a little bit of money from my speaking job and had invested all of it into a DSLR camera that Matt helped me find at Best Buy. Every time I filmed, my mom would come into my room, focus the camera, hit record, and leave. And then Matt would edit the videos for me afterwards. Have I mentioned that he was an amazing boyfriend? The first videos I made were super cringy, and I definitely advise against watching them, which probably means you're going to go straight to my channel and search for them. Oh well, what can I do? I think most YouTubers are embarrassed of their first videos, but we all have to start somewhere. Well, there's always been more than enough inspiration porn online. There really wasn't much of a disability community on YouTube at first. Only a handful of creators had disabilities, and that was it. When I began connecting with them, it was amazing to see that we all had a similar mission: break down stereotypes, educate, and build an inclusive community. But this comes with its own set of challenges. The disability community as a whole is such a small minority, and individual communities, like blind communities, are even smaller. We're a minority within a minority. And on top of that, we have a lot of intersectional identities, like a deaf person who's Latina, or a wheelchair user who's gay. A lot of disabled people end up identifying with other minority groups. Because the disability community is so small, it can feel like it's not going anywhere. It makes it really hard to build a community. This is also an issue in the entertainment industry as a whole. For a long time, I had given up on my childhood dream of becoming an actress, model, or singer because there was barely any representation of disabled people in mainstream media. And often, when they were represented, it was by able-bodied people. Like for many people, YouTube gave me a platform to make my dreams come true without waiting for somebody else to give me an opportunity. I'm still passionate about fighting for representation in mainstream media. And change is starting to happen, even though it's not happening fast enough. But I'll take the wins, because something is better than nothing. A year after I started making videos, and 2 years after I started dating Matt, it was time for one of those things to end. And clearly, it was not my YouTube channel. Matt and I broke up. We both had big dreams, and we just couldn't figure out how to fit those big dreams together. Yes, I made a tearful video about it, which is now private. Sorry for everyone who wanted to hear me cry about my breakup. And yes, now I had to find somebody else to edit my videos. And I was going to have to pay them more than the nothing I had been paying my boyfriend. Out of panic and the sheer dedication to my 3,000 followers that I'm sure eagerly awaited my uploads every Tuesday, I hired the first person I could think of that knew how to edit videos. 10 months later, the editor I had hired moved on to other work opportunities. I was a little disappointed, but now I'm glad it worked out the way it did, because it pushed me to find somebody who could really help me express my vision. It wasn't until I was on my fourth editor that I found somebody who could really help me express my creative vision. Shout out to you, Scott. I miss you. I went from using the awful YouTube auto-generated thumbnails and just hoping for the best to finding somebody who could truly represent my aesthetic. Cute custom thumbnails and all. One thing I've always loved about making YouTube videos is that it gives me ownership over my own story and how it's told. I've done a lot of TV, radio, and print interviews, and it's always great to have that kind of media exposure. But you also lose control over how your story is framed. They ask the questions they want, and they edit it how they want. I would do a magazine interview and not know what was written about me until the issue was already on store shelves. With YouTube, the final cut was always up to me. It was a process to find my own style and vibe, but I finally felt like I hit my stride a few years into it. Speaking of growing pains, I always hear from aspiring YouTubers how their channel wasn't growing, so they gave up. Let me just tell you, the hardest thing you'll ever do on YouTube is hitting your first 100 subscribers. It's so easy to compare yourself to YouTubers with tens of millions of subscribers, like Shane Dawson or Casey Neistat, and forget that they've been doing this for years. And just like you, they didn't hit that number overnight. It took me 2 years to get my first 5,000 subscribers. But I'm so glad I stuck with it, because at this point, I have almost 2 million subscribers, and I still love what I do. If you're really passionate about making online content, you can't give up. About 3 years into my channel, I stalled at 67,000 subscribers. YouTube Live had just come out and was being promoted as a great way to grow your channel, so I decided to give it a try. Couldn't hurt, right? I did one live video and immediately saw a huge drop in my subscribers, just from doing a simple Q&A. What? The next week, I tried going live again, and once again, my subscribers dropped. I didn't know what was going on. I had gotten really positive comments during and after the live stream, but I just seemed to hit a wall. I was trying everything I could think of to get over this hurdle, but nothing was working. My channel was still stuck when I was invited to attend my second ever VidCon as a featured creator. It was a huge honor to be representing disability on YouTube at the world's biggest online content convention, even though I was secretly obsessing a little bit about the rut my channel was in. On the last day of VidCon, my mom and I were hanging out in one of the few remaining creator-only lounges that hadn't been closed yet. It was a girly lounge with hair and makeup products. Are we surprised I could have been found there? And most importantly, it had food. Mini burgers, fries, that sort of thing. I was just a few feet away from the food table when somebody walked in and said, "I smell food in here." "Molly," my mom whispered, "it's that guy."
Which guy?
"The one with the glasses. You know, the sunglasses."
"Casey Neistat?"
The moment I said his name, Casey Neistat turned around and said,
Yeah? It was so awkward. I should have known he'd be able to hear me.
I started trying to explain, but that's when he noticed Gallop.
Hey, it's a dog, he said, and then dropped to the floor to snuggle him.
By now, you know you're not supposed to pet a working dog.
But I mean, it was Casey Neistat,
the guy who had created his own HBO show and gone rogue making a viral video for Nike. Not to mention the first person to hang from a human flying drone. I knew he didn't mean any harm, he just didn't know the rules.
This might be my one shot to talk to him, so I wasn't going to waste it asking him not to pet my dog.
Instead, I dropped down next to him and pitched him on a video idea as fast as I could. I explained that I'm a blind YouTuber and told him,
look, I have this series called Guess the YouTuber's Voice, where I sit down with a guest, have someone play a clip from a YouTube video, and try to guess who it is just by listening to their voice. We see who can get the most right.
I asked him if he'd film it with me, and he said, yeah, email me. Then he gave me his email and walked away. The whole exchange took maybe 2 minutes. One of the guys in the lounge was like, did that just happen?
Same random guy. Same.
A few days later, I was running from meeting to meeting when I got a call from my manager, Reuven. He had told me that the email Casey had given me was his burner email. Basically like the fake number you give somebody at a bar when you're not really interested. I didn't want to get my hopes up and had figured as much anyways. Later, Reuven and I were in the car together when he turned to me and said, let's just try it out right now. We typed up the email on my phone and sent it off. When I got to my friend's apartment about 20 minutes later, I already had a notification in my inbox. Casey had responded. Every fiber of my being was screaming with excitement. He invited me to go film some videos with him at his studio and asked me if I had any plans to be in New York. I didn't, but I wasn't about to lose this opportunity. I replied that my mom and I were actually going to be in New York soon for a girls' trip. A trip that was totally made up, but that was just a minor detail. I was taking a huge risk, but I didn't even think about it. I just knew that I had to make this video happen, no matter what. For the past few months, I had been pouring every dollar I had into my channel and trying to get it back up and going again. Paying better editors, getting all new equipment, building a filming studio in my parents' basement, and hiring consultants to see what I should try doing for growth. I barely had anything left to invest. And now it was going to be a huge expense to book flights, hotel rooms, and everything else that comes along with travel for me and my team. All just for the chance to work with Casey. I spent my last few dollars on this trip. If it fell through, I didn't know what I was going to do. My mom wasn't helping the vibe. She was even more worried than I was. Usually, the first person to look on the bright side came up with every worst possible scenario imaginable. Like, what if Casey's baby gets sick and he can't do it? What if he has an emergency meeting for the new app he's launching? Molly, what if your lower back pain flares up and you can't even walk? I just tried to tune out the worry and stay positive. The night before I was supposed to film with Casey, I was unpacking my outfit at the hotel room and realized I forgot to pack a bra. Meanwhile, the only shirt I brought to wear was white. I could not believe it. My mom pulled out her phone and we started frantically searching for nearby places to buy a bra. I went to a ton of different stores before I finally found one and bought a nude bralette that I kept the tags on so I could return it later. I was broke, remember? The next morning, after a nervous breakfast with my manager and videographer, we showed up at Casey's without any idea of what to expect. We had gone in, no pun intended, blindly, hoping to get at least an hour to film something for my channel. But he ended up giving us hours of his time, plural. We spent the whole afternoon there. When we got to the studio, he made me feel right at home by giving me a tour and showing me the fun things he thought I'd like. And then we filmed the Guess the YouTuber's Voice Challenge video. Afterwards, we chatted for at least an hour. He told me that he thought what I was doing really mattered, and my voice deserved to be heard. I almost never ask other YouTubers for favors. But here was Casey asking me how he could help and who he could connect me to. It was then that he said, "Well, this collab is going to help you grow. Let's film something for my channel." This was going to change everything. Everything we had done to get here was worth it. It was Casey's idea to start with a sit-down interview to get some of my story out there. And then I told him that I thought it would be fun to blindfold him and walk to the coffee shop together. And that was the video. I'll never forget how supportive he was. He was so present the entire time. His video sharing app, Beam, launched that same day. And even with all that must have been going on, he almost never checked his phone. After feeling like kind of a failure for so many months, having somebody like Casey believe in me was exactly what I needed to reignite my passion and belief in myself. A few weeks later, I was hanging out in my backyard live streaming on Instagram. At Molly Burke Official, feel free to follow me. Shameless self-promo. When my phone went off telling me I had a Facebook message from somebody that I hadn't talked to in years. OMG, you worked with Casey Neistat? I swear I almost dropped the phone. What? Casey must have released the video. He hadn't told me when he planned to post it, so this came as a complete surprise. I wrapped up the live stream as fast as I could and ran inside to go check YouTube. And there it was. I was in shock. The rest of that afternoon is kind of a blur. But I do remember we grabbed a bottle of champagne from the basement to chill. We're an Irish family. We've always got booze on hand. I couldn't even look at my subscriber count the whole day after the video came out. My friends were texting me updates throughout the evening, and soon they were texting, "Oh my God, you're going to hit 100,000. We decided we'd pop the bottle of champagne when I hit 100K. My dad got home from work just in time. He came into the backyard, we hit 100K, and he opened the bottle of champagne. By the next morning, I had already gained another 10,000 subscribers. And it felt like I had unlocked whatever had been frozen on my channel. Best of all, I had so many beautiful, supportive comments. From there, I was motivated to work harder than ever before. Adjusting to having a whole new level of scrutiny that came with having a bigger audience was more difficult than I had imagined. And I don't think I would have been able to do it if I hadn't found my self-confidence first. Thankfully, I had already done so much work on accepting who I was. And I was especially grateful for that now. I used to want to hide my blindness. I fought against learning Braille and had been embarrassed to use my cane. At the beginning of my channel, I even used to edit out my blind girl moments. But since then, I've learned that what makes me different is also what helps me stand out. My disability gives me a voice and a perspective that other people don't have. The thing I had often feared would hold me back in life ended up being the exact thing that opened up so many doors for me. And learning to embrace that has been one of the most rewarding lessons of my life. Chapter 9. You deserve this. Words like self-love and gratitude are thrown around a lot these days. They make for great Instagram captions and t-shirt slogans. But I don't think a lot of people truly make them a part of their day-to-day lives. It takes a lot of time and hard work. I didn't embrace who I am overnight, and self-love is still a daily process for me. Some people are natural-born optimists. But if you feel like you aren't and you want to be, all I have to say is, you can. Even though I've always had a bubbly, outgoing personality, optimism isn't necessarily my natural state. Just over a decade ago, I was so depressed that I wanted to end my own life. I hated myself and my situation. But once I hit rock bottom, I knew I had two options. End it and get out, or give it one last fight. And I'm so thankful I gave it one last fight. I not only recovered, but I overcame and surpassed what I ever thought possible. But I had to choose to do this. And I had to work really, really hard every single day. Every time I caught myself being negative, I would stop and make myself flip it into a positive. And after years of doing this, I've finally gotten to a place where being positive comes more naturally to me. When I was 16, I first read the self-help book, You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay, which is about the power and importance of affirmations. Her message made such a huge impact on me that it literally still plays a role in my life every single day. Affirmations are short, positive statements that you say to lift yourself up. It's so easy to tear yourself down by saying negative things to yourself like, I'm not good enough, or I really screwed that up. It's natural, especially when you're going through tough times, but it's also horribly destructive. We believe what we tell ourselves, whether it's negative or positive. And that's the idea behind affirmations. Even though it might feel silly at first, if you tell yourself positive messages every day, soon enough, you'll start to believe them and even become them. I've finished every single day since I was 16 by telling myself, you are strong, you are smart, you are beautiful, and you are talented. You deserve to be happy. You deserve to be healthy. You deserve to be successful, and you deserve to find love. You will never have to worry about your financial situation because money will always flow your way. Saying these things to myself felt super awkward at first, not to mention selfish and a little conceited. But by allowing myself to believe that I'm worthy enough of things like love and happiness, I've opened myself up to a world of opportunities. I'm also a huge believer in vision boards. Vision boards are having a moment lately, which is funny because people thought I was pretty weird when I did my first vision board 10 years ago. When my mom first brought the idea to me, it sounded really crazy and out there, just like a lot of my mom's ideas. Love you, Mom. But desperate times call for desperate measures, and I was ready to try just about anything. So we printed out some photos from the internet, glued them down on a cute, colorful piece of paper, and wrote all my hopes and dreams on it. To this day, I still have that original vision board. And believe it or not, there's only one thing on it that hasn't come true. I haven't been on Ellen. Yet. Let me tell you some of the very specific things I've put on vision boards that have come true. Winning the Miss Teen Canada International Beauty Pageant. Yes, I'm actually a beauty queen, no big deal. Don't worry, one day I'll tell you that story. Being in a Dove commercial. Yes, as weird as that might seem, I dreamed of being in a Dove campaign from the time I was 15. Back then, Dove was one of the only brands that was passionate about using real women instead of traditional actresses and models. I loved that about them. And every time I saw one of their campaigns, it made me feel more empowered. When I was up for a role in a Dove campaign more than 3 years ago, my chances were slim because they weren't even specifically looking for somebody that was blind. They were looking for new moms, athletes, artists, and me. Once they auditioned me, they fell in love with the idea of working with a blind woman and ended up calling in a lot more people to audition from around the world, including several of my blind girlfriends that I had introduced them to. Meanwhile, I didn't even know what brand I'd be working with until my third audition, and Dove had no idea about my passion for working with them until they called me in. When they finally cast me to be the face of Dove for a global ad campaign, I was shook. As someone who's very passionate about empowering others, they were a dream brand to work with. Yeah, vision boards can do some pretty crazy things. Whenever I sit down to create a new vision board, I just feel so fueled and inspired. I split them into four sections: career, relationships, life, and health. I use a combination of photos from magazines and the internet and words spelt out with stickers or markers. Then I put down whatever comes to mind. And I don't worry about seeming greedy or silly. Whatever I feel, I put down. I make them fun and colorful, and it doesn't even matter that I can't see what I created. You'd be surprised at how many of your role models use these techniques. Over the past few years, I've worked with so many successful people that also make vision boards and believe in allowing the universe to help them manifest their dreams. prayer is also a really important part of my life. I'm a spiritual person, and even though I don't follow any specific religion, I believe in the power of prayer. I was pretty frustrated with God when He made me blind, and I've done a lot of soul searching since then to figure out what I believe. When I was 11, I took an art class for blind kids with a potter named Sarah. Sarah was Buddhist, and during our pottery classes, she started teaching me some of the philosophies behind Buddhism. A few years later, when I was going through my toughest times, I kept remembering Sarah and the teachings she had shared with me. They were a real source of comfort. Today, I would say my beliefs are a mix of religions and philosophies, but I do pray every single night. It's a big part of my daily routine. Even though I don't know who or what is out there, I believe that somebody is out there guiding me, and there's a reason why things happen. This has brought me a lot of peace in my darkest hours. I know all this stuff can sound a little hokey, but when you're at the point of giving up, isn't it worth a try? If there is one affirmation I want to challenge you to implement in your daily life, it's this. I am not broken. I am whole. And I am good enough as I am. Even when you feel like you have nothing left, you can still reach deep inside and find a sliver of hope. And that's a very powerful emotion. The hope that you'll heal, overcome, and find happiness. The hope that your dreams will still come true. Even if you feel lost right now, I have that hope for you. Chapter 10. The best part is giving back. We're getting to the end of this audio excursion. So let's wrap it all up with something warm and fuzzy. I'm 25, I have purple hair, I live in LA, and I'm living my best life. It's been one hell of a journey to get to where I am. And the stories I've shared have only scratched the surface of everything I've been through. Every day I continue to question whether or not my life is real. Whenever I have a new opportunity and think, life can't get any better, something else comes along and I get to check another thing off my bucket list. One of those things has been being able to give back to those who have helped me along my journey. Because, as you've probably gathered at this point, I haven't gotten here alone. Have you ever heard of the five love languages? If you haven't, I highly recommend Googling it real quick and figuring out what your love language is. Both how you give and receive love. I give love by gift giving. I love nothing more than giving gifts to the people who matter most to me. It doesn't have to be a holiday or a special occasion. Just a regular Wednesday will do. Whether it's taking a friend out to lunch or treating my mom to the smile makeover she's always dreamed of. It's just how I show that I care and appreciate people. I'm not always very good at giving my time. And I've definitely had to get better at expressing verbal affection. Typical Aquarius. But I am a master at gift giving. For a while now, I've been trying to work on going back to people who have been pivotal in my life and giving them something. This past year, I had the opportunity to go back to my old high school and surprise my amazing role model and mentor, Tracy Beck, with $15,000 thanks to Benefit Cosmetics. $10,000 for the school and $5,000 just for her. Yep, that Tracy. My high school special ed teacher who changed my life by teaching me about the social model of disability. When Benefit Cosmetics first offered to make this generous gift, I decided I didn't want to accept any type of personal compensation for this campaign because I wanted the focus to be on Tracy. I wanted her to know that it was a gift I was truly giving from the heart and not for some kind of ulterior motive. I'm not saying we all have to go around being like Oprah and giving away checks and dental veneers to everyone we love. But I feel so lucky that I'm in a position where I occasionally get to do that. But a hug, a thank you, an I love you can also go a long way. I spent so many years being angry, and it feels so much better to be grateful. It feels better deep down in my soul. But it's not always easy, because the negative things in life are usually the most obvious. It would be so easy for me to pour all of my energy into being upset about unemployment in the blind community, dating violence towards disabled women, judgment by society, that I can't ride a bike on my own or drive a car. But by putting in just a little bit of effort, I can see all the things that I have to be grateful for, too. I get to have an amazing dog that I'm so bonded with. I get to be a part of a really unique community. I'm not fazed by blackouts. And I can read with my fingers. That's just cool. There will always be negatives in just about any situation. So I'd rather just make the best of the life I've been given and enjoy it. And trust me, there are still things that suck every day. And those are the things that I could choose to dwell on if I wanted to. But it just feels so much better to say, wow, life is good. I often get asked about what happened to the girls who bullied me when I was younger. People want to know where they are now and if they've ever reached out. They want that closure for me. But ultimately, I don't think it matters if I've heard from them or not, because a long time ago, I forgave them within myself. It's not like I sent them a DM on Instagram. Hey, just want to let you know I forgive you. It was more like a feeling inside of me that shifted somewhere along this journey of gratitude. When I decided to forgive the people who hurt me, instead of holding on to my anger and sadness, I took away their power and freed myself to move on. I chose to give my energy to the people who have done the right thing in my life, instead of the people who have done the wrong thing in my life. And that, to me, is gratitude. I choose to give thanks to the people who have supported me and move on from the people who haven't. So many people live their whole lives trying to find their purpose. I'm lucky that my circumstances handed me my passion and my purpose at a really young age. Being blind, it often feels like I have to try 10 times harder to make something look just as easy. And I have to be 10 times better to be accepted as equal. It's exhausting. It's why I sleep so much and drink so much green tea. But those are just the cards I was dealt in life. And I feel this burning desire to educate and break down stereotypes. It can be difficult sometimes because most people get to walk away from their job, and I never do. Even if I'm not technically working, the moment I walk into a coffee shop or try to cross the street, and somebody has a question about my guide dog or my blindness, I'm compelled to answer it because I might be the only blind person they ever meet. And I want to give them the opportunity to learn something so they don't keep walking around with misconceptions. It's important to understand that not all disabled people feel this way. A lot of my disabled friends just want to have a regular job. They want to get married, have kids, and live a normal life. When people ask them questions about their disability, they don't necessarily want to talk about it because they're just trying to do their thing and get through the day. I have friends that have gone blind in extremely traumatic ways because they were shot in the head or from suicide attempts gone wrong. If strangers asked you about that every day, I don't think you'd want to talk about it either. And I respect that, but that's not me. When I was 11, this guy came up to me and said, "You know, I went to one of those fundraisers you spoke at years ago because my girlfriend made me go. I thought I would donate one time just to impress her and that would be it. But then I saw you speak, and I've donated every year since." It was really exhilarating to know that I could make that kind of impact on just one life by sharing my story and speaking out. It's one of the reasons I've continued to do it. I know that I was meant to be this person. Retinitis pigmentosa is genetic, but nobody in my family's history has ever had it, or probably ever will in the future, according to my geneticist, because my gene mutation is so rare. And in my specific form of RP, TULIP1 is extremely rare, with the vision loss happening at such a young age. So I have one of the rarest forms of a rare disease, as well as these other random rare diseases that don't usually go with it. And having been, quote, sighted and now being blind, I feel like I'm in a very unique position to bridge the gap and come up with relatable ways to express what I see and feel as a blind person. On top of all of this, my particular talents and interests lie in entertainment and public speaking. Even a lot of my family has background working in marketing and media. When I look at my specific circumstances, I know that this wasn't an accident. this really is who I was meant to be. Whoever it is that's out there in the universe that's guiding me, they handed me this life because they knew I could do this. They knew I could help change things for other disabled people. And it's why I work so hard to do what I do. They gave me this set of cards because they knew I would play them damn well. And I like to think I am. I'm so sad that we've come to the end of our time together, but it's really just the beginning. You and I both have so much work left to do. I chose these parts of my story to share with you because I hope that, with each chapter in my story, you've been able to take away something for yourself, too. Whatever you might be going through in your life, I hope this will give you that extra little push or reassurance that you need. So, to wrap this up properly, let's do a quick recap of the lessons I've shared in each chapter. Here we go. We all get stuck sometimes. When you feel stuck, reach out to that one person in your life who you feel like can help give you answers. They might not always be the answers you want, but sometimes we don't actually know what's best for us and need support from family and friends to figure it out. You deserve to find happiness and peace. You deserve to recover and move on, and I know you can do it. But remember, recovery is never linear. It's going to be filled with ups and downs, like those dreaded roller coasters. But this is one roller coaster that's damn worth riding. If you're the parent of a child that's going through something like I did, be an advocate and help them find their spark and their voice. It's not always easy, but trust me, it's always worth it. It's okay to feel sad or scared when your child is facing the unknown. But don't worry, we're all built to be resilient. When life hands you a situation that you don't think you're going to be able to handle, you just do, because that's your only option. When you can't accept something, change it. And if you can't change it, accept it. Acceptance, like recovery, is a journey and doesn't come overnight. When you live to make yourself happy and not just to prove something or impress people, life is so much better. It's way easier to love the person you are when you're being authentic. I also want you to remember that the next time you run into somebody with a disability, we aren't all that different from you. Don't treat us like we're an inspiration just for being alive. One thing I can say with great confidence is that I'm not defined by my disability. I'm defined by the strength of my character. And the same goes for everyone else. We're defined by who we are, not by the challenges we might deal with. So with that in mind, talk to us like we're human beings. Show us respect and treat us as equals. If you've ever struggled with loss and saying goodbye, you aren't the only one. I have to be honest with you here and say, it's never going to be easy. So cherish the time you have and keep moving forward, no matter what. You will get through it, this time and the next time and the time after that. Whenever you feel lost, just remember that failure is a part of life. We need to fail in order to learn and improve. And sometimes what might feel like failure is really just the start of something better. Allow yourself to face challenges head on, without fear. Because the only thing fear really does is hold us back. You have to be willing to take risks and not give up when things aren't going your way. When doors aren't opening in life, get up and open them for yourself. Please, if you ever feel hopeless or like you have nothing left, reach down deep inside and find the hope I know is within you. We all have it. Even in the darkest of times, it's there. Make a vision board, even if you can't see it. Start saying positive affirmations to yourself every day. Soon you'll start to believe them and even become them. And finally, choose to give thanks to those who have supported you and move on from the people who haven't. Forgiveness is the gift you give yourself. Free yourself from the pain of your past and fill your heart with the warmth of gratitude from all that you have and all that you are. It will make your soul feel so much better. When you forgive the people that have hurt you, you take away their control. So forgive, take back control, and live your best life. I know you can do this, and I'm already excited for you. Now, open your eyes. Epilogue. Blind girls like to read too, you know. And now it's time for me to thank you for sticking with me to the end of this journey. As my thank you gift to you, keep listening to hear a list of my top 10 audiobooks to check out next. Audiobooks have been a big part of my life ever since my diagnosis. At first, the only place I could get audiobooks was on cassette tapes at the local library, and the selection was really limited. When kids at school would start talking about a cool book that everyone was reading, I'd have to ask my mom to read it to me so I wouldn't feel left out. But she would only be able to get through a few pages before falling asleep. It frustrated me to no end. And as I was getting older, a lot of the popular books had kissing scenes and stuff like that, which was so embarrassing to hear my mom read. When CDs came out, I got a Victor Reader, which could play special CD formats called Daisy Books. The Canadian National Institute for the Blind had their own library of Daisy Books, and they had way more options than my local library. But the books were read by volunteers, and the quality was pretty spotty. Not everyone is born to read an audiobook, you know. It's a talent. Then, when iTunes came on the scene, it made things easier. R.I.P. iTunes. But it was still far from perfect, because they wouldn't have the whole series of anything. They would just have a random book from the series, and I was like, are you kidding me? You're going to give me book 7 and that's it? That's when I discovered Audible and got my first subscription. I still have that same subscription and use it every month. It might sound like I'm doing a paid promotion for Audible, but seriously, I have been their biggest stan from the start. For those who don't know, a stan is a super fan. I bet you're ready for my top 10 list. So let's do this. In no particular order. 1. You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. As I mentioned earlier, this book changed my life by teaching me how to do affirmations. Every night I start out by telling myself, you are strong, you are smart, you are beautiful, and you are talented. You deserve to be happy. I say it every single night. It's the last thing I tell myself before I go to bed. 2. The Giver by Lois Lowry. This was my favorite book when I was a teenager, asking all the usual questions teenagers have about life, plus all the questions I had about why I was going blind. I took it with me to the Mira Foundation when I was away getting gypsy, and I read it probably 10 times that month. I was obsessed with this mysterious, the world outside, and what it had cost this little society to get rid of pain and fear. I actually really want to reread The Giver. 3. Look Again by Lisa Scottolini. Lisa Scottolini is my all-time favorite author. It's funny that I love crime books so much now because I grew up terrified of being kidnapped. Think about it. I was night blind. Before I would go to bed, I would overhear awful stories about kids being kidnapped on the news. If I heard noises, I couldn't look around to see what they were. Reading about crime now makes me feel less afraid, because the unknown is what makes you scared in life. With crime books like Lisa Scottolini's, you know there's going to be a satisfying solution. And she always writes two climaxes. So just when you get the answer you've been waiting for, and you think it's going to wind down, boom, she hits you again. It's brilliant. 4. Confessions of a Shopaholic by Sophie Kinsella. My other favorite author is Sophie Kinsella. Her books are happy, quirky, funny, and light. They're beach reads. She couldn't be any more different than Lisa Scottolini. But I love them both equally. Her Shopaholic series are these cute books about a woman who loves shopping. Sound like anyone you know? Guilty, it feels like these books were made for me. I've been listening to them since I was like 10 years old. So now whenever she writes a new book, I have to read it because she's been with me for so much of my life. Also, humble brag, she follows me on Twitter. 5. The Summer I Turned Pretty by Jenny Han. A lot of people know Jenny Han as the amazingly talented creative genius behind To All the Boys I've Loved Before. But they might not realize that she wrote two entire series before that. My personal favorite is The Summer I Turned Pretty, which is about a girl named Isabel, or Belly for short, who has a crush on one of the boys that spends the summer at the same vacation home as her family. But his younger brother has a crush on Belly. Ooh, the plot thickens. There's something so satisfying about a great love triangle. 6. Openly Straight by Bill Konigsberg. I got so wrapped up in this love story about two boys who meet at an all-boys school in New England. It reminded me of friends I grew up with in the LGBTQ+ community and helped me have a better understanding of what it was like for them to come out and fall in love for the first time. It's such a unique love story, and there's even a sequel, Honestly, Ben. 7. Sticks and Stones by Emily Bazelon. This book on teen bullying should be required reading for all parents and teachers. Emily Bazelon is an expert on bullying and did a lot of research to break down the misunderstandings around it. She puts a real face to the problem by sharing stories of three different teens dealing with bullying. I really wish this book had been around when I was in school. 8. Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. I'm from that classic Mean Girls era. So, of course, I wanted to get to know the creator behind one of the most iconic movies of all time. Confession time, I've even watched a video on 107 unknown Mean Girls facts you should know. Tina Fey is so witty, and I loved hearing her tackle silly and serious topics in her own voice. P.S. Celebrity memoirs are one of my favorite genres, and so much better to listen to in audio form because the celebrity actually reads it themselves. 9. Lola Rose by Jacqueline Wilson. This is one of the books I read during a childhood hospital stay when I was doing an overnight sleep test. It's a British children's book about a family who's going through a really frightening time and escapes to London, where they start over and choose fancy new names so their past can't catch up with them. I loved how this story mixed a glamorous fantasy world with real-life problems. 10. He's Just Not That Into You by Greg Berendt and Liz Tuchillo. There was this used bookstore I used to go to all the time with my mom, and the owner was really dedicated to sourcing audiobooks for me. He would go out of his way to special order used audiobooks for me based on what was popular for my age. That's how I found He's Just Not That Into You. It actually taught me a lot about dating, and my mom always used to say how impressed she was about how much I knew about relationships at such a young age. Maybe I need to read that again. Acknowledgements. In the spirit of gratitude, I'd like to give a quick shout out to the people and organizations that have helped shape my life so far. Even if they're never on the trending page of YouTube or popping off on Instagram, they've made a difference to my life and to so many others. So in no particular order, thank you to Reuven Ashtar, Mesa Kronhaus, Kelly Noggle, Shane Dawson, Casey Neistat, Braden Schwartz, Extreme Mobility Games, Matthew Ellies, Scott Navarro, Rachel Stinson, Tracy Beck, Marilyn Turner, Rena Killian, Christina Raschuti, Dr. Elise Ion, Ryan Switzer, Judith Lander, Craig Kielberger, Mark Kielberger, Marianne Woods, Hope McAdam, Michelle Dudas, Ted Cooper, Anthony McLaughlin, Kelly Kerr, Brenda Barr, Shannon Holmes and Aigita, the Foundation Fighting Blindness Canada, the Mira Foundation, Sick Kids Hospital, Canada Lions Club, Yo Mustafa and West End Studios, the YMCA, Youth Leadership Camps Canada, Views, the Toronto Ski Hawks, Sunrise Farms, Lole, Me to We, Free the Children, the Starter Company Program and Accessible Media Inc., Dove, Samsung Global, Aerie, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, VidCon, YouTube, Instagram, Stacey Lewis, Dr. Neil Hadier, and to all of my extended family around the world. And to anybody else I might have forgotten, I'm so sorry. I love you. And of course, the ones who really go without saying, Gypsy and Gallop. My eyes, my best friends, my sidekicks, my kids, my second halves. And above and beyond all, my mom, Neve, my dad, Peter, and my older brother, Brady. Without all of you, I truly don't know where or who I would be. Thank you for not giving up on me when I gave up on myself. Thank you for your support, unconditional love, and for always being exactly what I need. I really lucked out to have a family like you. Oh, and how could we forget? Audible. The reason we're all here. Thanks for empowering people like me to read and for giving me the opportunity to share just a small slice of my story.
This has been an Audible Originals production of It's Not What It Looks Like, written and performed by Molly Burke. Executive producers David Blum, Joanne Parrots, and Mike Charzik. Editorial producers Maggie Murphy and Rachel Smalter Hall. Producer Chris Sacco. Directed by Chris Sacco. Mixed and mastered by Joe Dell'Aquila. Copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.